Welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday, 5th of April, with me, Ian Welsh. We've got a bumper episode for you this week. While at the recent Innovation Forum Responsible Sourcing and Ethical Trade Conference in London, I reflected on some of the conversations at the event with Sam Ludlow-Taylor from John Lewis Partnership, Peter McAllister from the Ethical Trading Initiative, and Wayne Jordash from Business and Human Rights Compliance. Plus, when he was in India recently, Innovation Forum's Toby Webb spoke with Alison Ward and Dawa Dorji from Cotton Connect about how the cotton sector is tackling its impacts, moving to a more regenerative approach and improving farmer livelihoods. That's coming up. First, though, is some sustainable business news. There is a significant gap between the global generation of electronics waste and the capacity to recycle it, with the former growing perhaps as much as 5 times faster than the latter. This is according to the most recent edition of the UN's Global E-Waste Monitor, which tracks global waste and recycling levels. The report says that 62 million tonnes of e-waste were produced in 2022, which is 80% higher than when the data was first recorded in 2010. This increase is primarily down to higher rates of consumption and shorter product lifestyles, the UN says. There is some more positive news in that the recycling rates are increasing, up from 17.4% in 2019 to 22.3% in 2022. There are some stark geographical differences, though. The latest report points out that while recycling rates in Europe are greater than 40%, less than 1% of e-waste is recycled in Africa. The trend towards exporting waste continues. 10% of e-waste in 2022 was transported across borders or shipped elsewhere. As in the past, this tends to be from the global north to south, with two-thirds exported from wealthier to poorer countries. Waste watchers point out that there is real economic value in much of the e-waste that is unrecycled. The UN says that the benefits from more investment in repair, reuse and recycling would easily cover any upfront costs. At the most recent meeting of European Union agriculture ministers, the vast majority of them, 20 out of 27, voted to support proposals by the Austrian minister to revise the EU's deforestation regulation. Reports emerge that Austria wants to significantly reduce the deforestation certification burdens for companies and to postpone the deadline of 30th December 2024 for member states to be in compliance with the regulation. The argument is, essentially, that the new obligations place unreasonable burden on companies in Europe in the agriculture sector to prove that anything imported into the EU containing any of a number of key commodities is deforestation free. Environmental campaigners have objected to the proposed watering down of the regulation, with Mighty Earth and others calling on the European Commission to stand firm, given the regulation was passed by the institutions of the EU in June 2023. Another factor influencing the jostling could well be the European parliamentary elections coming up in June. Since the Paris Agreement on Climate in 2016, the 117 biggest emitting companies in the coal, gas and cement production sectors, referred to as the carbon majors, have in fact grown their carbon footprint, according to new research from Influence Map. And a mere 57 of these companies are linked to 80% of the planet's emissions since 2016. Of the carbon majors, 65% of the state-owned companies and 55% of the investor-owned companies had increased production in the period 2016 to 2022, compared with 2009 to 2015. The top five highest emitters were all state-owned: Saudi Aramco, Gazprom, Coal India, the National Iranian Oil Company, and Rosneft. The investor-owned fossil fuel giants weren't far behind, with ExxonMobil and Shell both in the top 10. The trend for emission growth in the Asian state fossil fuel sector is perhaps a standout finding. The International Energy Agency has warned, after all, that only no new fossil fuel expansion is compatible with keeping global temperature rises within the Paris Agreement's targets. At Innovation Forum's recent Responsible Sourcing and Ethical Trade Conference in London, I spoke with Sam Ludlow-Taylor from John Lewis Partnership and Peter McAllister from the Ethical Trading Initiative, and also with Business and Human Rights Compliance's Wayne Jordash. Joining me now are Peter McAllister from ETI and Sam Ludlow-Taylor from John Lewis Partnership. We've just been going back over the day and going through some of the things that our delegates think we missed from the first day here in London. One thing that came up a lot earlier was talking about auditing and compliance, and we've been talking about auditing for years, the effectiveness of auditing and the pros and cons. But a question came up from our delegates was, is manufacturing auditing more effective than agricultural auditing, Peter?
I think the reality is in manufacturing, you've got people, processes, materials all within a defined space. And that does lend itself to auditing in a way which agriculture, typically with seasonal workers or smallholders, doesn't. I think they both have the same positives, which it gives you a snapshot, but they also have the same limitations.
Sam? I guess the only other thing I would add on there is that it really depends on your definition of an audit, because an audit can mean all sorts of things. And to the point around having different tools in your box, different methodologies may work better or worse in different places.
Something else that came up was human rights due diligence into contracts, writing it into contracts. Peter, how feasible is that, do you think?
Well, I think it is, and people often refer to their codes and their expectations, but it's not sufficient. So I think the nature of the relationship, how you reward people telling you things are happening and what they've done about it, is as important as the contract. But the contract's a good start to set up those expectations.
Is the devil in the detail around getting these sort of things into contracts, do you think, Sam?
I think it depends on exactly what you want to say in there. I mean, overarching, we do have in all of our contracts requirements around labour conditions in the form of our responsible sourcing code of practice, which is essentially the UTI base code. So can it be done? Absolutely. And it's a good starter for a conversation.
Process effectiveness, something else that we were asked to think about a bit more, and what are the right checks and how to design them into the process itself. How do you make sure that what you're doing is effective, Peter?
Well, I think this is a difficult one because certainly processes around manufacturing and even around carbon measurement and so forth are fairly well defined, whereas we know that the processes in human rights and the ESG are much more difficult and not as well defined. It is important to have processes. Is it important to learn from those processes? Is important to then refine and change those processes over time? But we know that those processes aren't as robust as we'd probably like them to be.
Tim?
I guess the only other thing that I would add to that is that I think you've got to be really clear on what you are trying to achieve with your process. And if you are not clear on what you're trying to achieve, you can't put any form of measurement against it. And I think there's an option there for you to do both numerical measurements, so you can have quantitative data, but also qualitative data as well. So asking the people who the process was supposed to positively impact, for example, whether it did.
The final thing that we picked out was remediation. We had a question about what does the process of long-term effective remediation look like? But I guess, Peter, we've got to think in terms of short-term remediation too.
I think any form of remediation revolves around what harm has been done and to whom and to what extent they've been involved in defining that remediation. So if someone has lost their wages, for example, then it might be just repaying the wages is an effective form of remediation. However, it might be that if you're competing with a community on a water source, you need a much longer, more strategic effort to remediate, both in terms of what needs to be done and in terms of to making that actually land.
Sam?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think remediation is a very individual piece. If you feel that you have had successful remediation, then only you will be able to be the person that would ask that. And then I think the other thing is around making sure that you learn your lessons and make sure that you don't do it next time.
Yep. One final thing that you both came up with was that we've discussed unintended consequences of actions today, but it feels like the conversation need to develop a bit further.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we need to be really careful where we make decisions that we think about the unintended consequences. But I think we also need to remember that unintended consequences are not always negative. And actually, there are some really positive unintended consequences we have about failures, but we all have a responsibility to make sure we've followed that next step.
Peter, we've been talking about regulation a lot today. There certainly are some unintended consequences of lots of big pieces of legislation that are just coming in.
There are, and I think on balance, it's a good thing that we're starting to raise the oar boats because some companies have been doing HRDD in a meaningful way, but many haven't. But as Sam has said, we need to be mindful of looking for those unintended consequences. If they're positive, celebrating and learning from them, and if they're negative, trying to avoid those in the future.
Well, it's certainly been a great day of conversation. Sam and Peter, thanks so much for making sense of some of it for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm joined by Wayne Jordash, who's a managing partner at Business and Human Rights Compliance. How would you characterise the evolving global legislative landscape for business and human rights?
Well, I would say we are in a real moment of inflection, or even more, a moment of transformation. I think we've watched over the last decade the soft instruments, UN guiding principles, OECD guidelines, industry standards, and so on, develop increasingly into more demanding regulation, reporting, obviously a Modern Slavery Act to the UK, but many others, and then a movement into due diligence legislation and tougher reporting legislation, to a point now where we've got the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive, which applies to a limited number of European companies, but has real rigor and it's hard law. If you're a company now, you have a lot to look at, you have a lot to take into account. And I think where we are is really a moment where that will cause a lot of confusion, it will cause a lot of work. Companies will really have to apply themselves in a way that they haven't to due diligence requirements, to reporting standards. There will be chaos for a while, or at least managed chaos, and I think it will be challenging. once that's worked through, where we are is that the legislation will harmonise. I think the CSDDD will do a lot of that, but also the efforts by the Dutch, the Norwegians, the different national efforts to legislate on these important issues, I think are coming to fruition and will eventually harmonise and lead to a clearer picture, but we're not there yet.
There was always a sense that being reactive on these issues was enough in the past, but that's no longer the case, is it?
Companies will still, I think, be reactive, but it's not enough. What we can see, I think, at the moment, as companies realising, well, they cannot no longer be reactive, the progressive or more forward-looking companies have already prepared for this, or for this changing landscape, for this hardened legislation. The rest of the companies will be catching up, and I think that will be difficult. But yes, no longer able to be just reactive. Now there's going to be proper, hard requirements on proper hard processes. Due diligence is not necessarily straightforward when you're a global company here.
Across the number of conversations we've had over the past couple of days at the conference, I get the sense you're quite excited about the CSDDD. Why is that?
First of all, I'm an international lawyer, a studier of the way that law evolves. I'm a great adherent to the force of hard law. I think human nature works in such a way that enforcement is really what drives change. And so I think there's a need for change in the environment. I think there's a need for companies to be more than reactive. And I think that CSDDD is the first real hard law, certainly in the EU, probably globally in relation to due diligence, that's going to drive change. And I think that change is a good thing for communities. It's a good thing for supply chains, and it's ultimately a good thing for business. It's a good thing for international lawyers too.
Indeed, years of fruitful work. Over the course of our preparation for this event, the CSDDD went from being on to being off to being back on again. Do you think it's going to be fully implemented in an effective manner?
That's a very good question, because I think what we saw in the negotiations and the directive process of it being voted on was a lot of less than straightforward behaviour from certain countries, Germany, Italy. When everything looked as though it was agreed, changes were made, concessions had to be made, and these concessions were a bit unseemly. Now, member states have an obligation now to create supervisory authorities. So if they behave the same way as some of them did in relation to the legislation or the directive itself, then we're going to have some difficulty creating supervisory authorities which really have the kind of teeth that they're anticipated or envisaged to have. So I hope that member states will be fair and approach this directive with the spirit and the letter it was intended. But time will tell.
Indeed it will. It's going to be fascinating to see how it all pans out. Wayne Jordash, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Innovation Forum's Toby Webb was in India recently with the team from Cotton Connect to record a documentary about cotton supply chains, which will be published later this month to coincide with the Sustainable Apparel and Textiles Conference in Amsterdam. While he was in India, he spoke with Cotton Connect's Alison Ward and Dawia Dorji about how the cotton sector can move to a more regenerative approach and work with farming communities at scale.
Dawia, for the benefit of the listeners, tell us where we are right now.
So at the moment, we are sitting in one of our program partners, Jinner Cum Spinner facility in Kadi, which is close to Ahmedabad in the state of Gujarat in India.
Alison, we worked with you for about 10 years through Cotton Connect, before that for many years in other ventures. Why have you invited me here to see your farmers and today to sit and talk to Jinners? And of course, we have Malin Baker along with us, who we collaborate with at Innovation Forum. So why are we here?
We wanted you to follow the journey of cotton, right from the farmer. Then here today, you've seen the lorries unloading from that bought from the farmers into the gin and then into the spinning process as well. And one of the big achievements over the last 10 years is being able to provide traceable cotton. And I think when I joined Cotton Connect, everyone said it was too difficult, the supply chain's opaque, it's impossible. But actually, we've been able to do it. And I think it's great to show you and your expertise in other supply chains what we've done. And then hopefully, through your network, we can also learn about how we can take it forward in cotton, looking at other commodities as well.
Well, listener, you'll be hearing more about this in the coming months, because Malin and I have been doing a lot of filming and interviews. We're going to put together a little documentary about a story of traceable, sustainable into regenerative cotton. So keep an eye out on that on the Innovation Forum channels over the next couple of months. But let's just preview it a bit. Let's talk about where we've been and what we've seen. Let's talk about the cotton production, first of all. We've been out in the fields, out in various villages, visiting farmers. What have you been trying to show us, Dawa, over the last week or so?
The basic objective was to show across all entire end-to-end supply chain and the solution that we offer for our sustainable cotton program. As you have visited and seen and met with all the key stakeholders, right from the farmers to the processors. So taking you through this journey so that you understand and get a fair idea about the entire processes that are involved, including all our checks, measures and balances in the entire system through traceability, through verification processes, etc. And how each of our processors function within their respective capacity, following the detailed SOPs laid out for them.
It's been a fascinating week. We've been to villages that say real regenerative on the sign. Now, just explain what real is and tell us, Alison, why are these villages regenerative? I know you're not concerned about throwing that term around because some people think it's greenwash. How is it different from sustainable? So just give us that picture.
Absolutely. A real program is a code which outlines a number of agricultural practices, and then it's first, second and third priority verified. So it's a code that ensures for brands and retailers that we know what's happening at a farm level, but it's also best practices for farmers so that they know that they're producing cotton which is more sustainable and better for their environment and livelihoods. 3 years ago, we developed a regenerative section of that code, so we now have a real regenerative code. Regenerative, as we know, is a really popular theme at the moment, and you've covered it, Toby, in some of your webinars and your meetings. What's interesting, a lot of the practices for regenerative started in Indore in India. So the Indore composting technique is really famous, and that's often the base of regenerative practices in the UK and US. We're almost coming back to the roots of good farming practice here in India. And this week we visited farmers who are in their second year of regenerative training, really to learn from them about how this applies to smallholder agriculture, what we need to adapt and change, and really how the farmers are benefiting from these new techniques of farming.
So we've seen some real progress numbers from CotCollect on how things are improving. But are you going to raise the bar over time? I mean, let's say you get a 30% reduction in pesticide and fertilizer use, 20% increase in yield, a 25% increase in farmers' income. So I'm pulling those numbers out of the air. Those are not official CotConnect numbers, but it's in that kind of ballpark. What's good enough to stay regenerative? Where do you want to get to in the villages that you're at the moment?
So I think for farmers, there's still more to do. One of the big parts about regenerative is tillage. In most regenerative practices, there shouldn't be tilling of the soil because it obviously breaks the soil down. The idea in India of talking to a farmer about not tilling is really difficult. It's so ingrained in terms of how the village operates. There's oxen that till. In fact, I had a conversation last year with some field executives and I asked them about it and they couldn't even understand the question I was asking about not tilling. There's some way to go, and I think we have to go at the pace of farmers. I think we have to make it appropriate for India. At CotConnect, we don't just plonk things into a market. We adapt them for that context. So I think it's more farmers doing more regenerative practices. So ideally, over time, all of our work would be regenerative. I think that's personally my goal. And then as we look at the farm, and you saw the farmers are growing local grains that they're selling in the market. There's fruit and vegetables. All of that is actually in a regenerative farm. So there's an opportunity, I think, for farmers to have a regenerative offer across their farm, which I think would bring in more income and be really appealing for consumers here in India.
So you start out focusing on cotton as a crop, but then that expands into the village practices and the practices they use to create other crops which they either can sell or use themselves. Dawa, what sort of farm sizes are we talking about? Give us that context.
So on a very broad scale, if we talk about, there are two quite distinct differences, I would say. One, which is quite typical to the entire Indian subcontinent, and when I say that, I mean India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, where you have typically the small landholder farmers. You're talking on an average of about 1.5 to about 2 acres per farmer, which is entirely different in Turkey. There, small landholder farmers are farmers with about 20 hectares plus. So that's huge as per Indian standard, and they call it small farmers, small laboratory farmers. The other part is the mechanized and more advanced form of farming, which is practiced in Turkey, where they use, because of course of the large land holding size, They use more advanced technologies, machineries, equipments, and drones as well. So more advanced technology-based solution is what is already almost inherently incorporated in the farming practices in Turkey. Whereas if you talk about Gujarat or India in general, due to the smaller landholder size and other reasons and factors as well, the farming practices are a lot more traditional. So where you use, you know, manual to other smaller equipments a lot more in our farming.
I'm really fascinated to know how an almost entirely India-based social enterprise dealing with smallholders for a long time can go to Turkey and deal with mechanized larger landholders and get anything done. It sounds incredible. How has that process worked? And what were some of the challenges? And what have been some of your early stage outcomes from working in Turkey?
So I'd give that credit largely to Alison. It was primarily her vision to expand into different geographies that offer and provide various solutions for the entire sector. And of course, since we are in this agriculture-specific sector, so we were looking at various geographies. Turkey definitely is on the world map with regards to amongst the largest supplier, let's say particularly for the cotton. The other reason was the market driven, the demands from customers, because Turkey being very close to the European market, so Turkey by default has that interest from the customer as well. So it was a combination of Alison's vision and the demand from the market that drove us to experiment and reach out into various, I mean, rather expand to various geographies. So that's how Turkey being one of them.
So that's great to understand why you're there. But now, Alison, I'm sure you talk us through the next bit of how the process is taking place and how you link regenerative work in Gujarat with regenerative work in Turkey when the farms and the process are completely different.
I mean, we're really fortunate. We've got some really talented individuals at Cotton Connect. Now, we have a group of agronomists, and in Pakistan, we have Arif Magdoum, who's a really expert agronomist, and he went to Turkey. And I think at the beginning, they were like, well, what can we learn? And then they began to listen to Arif and learn about his expertise in cotton agronomy. And I think one day he just pulled up the soil and showed them that there was nothing in the soil. There was no life in the soil. There were no worms. There were no insects because so much pesticide had been applied and it was so compacted.
Just to backtrack a little, how do you find these farms? I mean, you don't just turn up in eastern Turkey and go, anyone know any cotton farmers I could lecture about regen? How do you find them?
So we have a method of working with local partners or with local organisations, and then we go through a criteria of farmer recruitment.
How long did that take to get that group together where you could say your soil has no life?
It's probably 1 to 2 years to really find the right people and then gain trust, because it's a bit like at home, you know, somebody knocks on your door and says they can help you do something different. I mean, most of us would be like, well, really, can you? And so you have to find somebody who's prepared to test some of the new techniques. And I think at that moment with Arif and the soil, and I think they suddenly went, oh, wow, yeah, there's nothing there. And actually, farmers in Turkey were spraying pesticides, and it's like 6 more times, isn't it? They were just putting so much pesticide on them. They didn't need to. It needs to be applied properly, so it has to go under the leaf. Mm. But if you do sort of a global spray above the plant, it's just not getting to those sucking pests.
So, Dara, talk us through how you got them towards regen. Because the description I've heard from you last was effectively making them better farmers, and then we're calling it regen. Is that enough?
Well, I would say at least it's a start. It's definitely not easy venturing into any new geographies due to various reasons. And one of the reasons for Turkey was a very tough and a rigid mindset, because of course they have been practicing the farming through their equipments and technologies and methods for years and generations. Of course, the results were right before their eyes, tried and tested results. So to bring about any improvement in those mindset and the practices, it does take time, a lot of convincing. One needs to have a very good and strong knowledge of what we are talking about and our practices. And B, a lot of it has to be demonstration-based, which is what our standard practices. I'd like to also add our collaborations also, both at domestic or a local level to the international collaborations with various organizations, bodies, and experts definitely helps add and build to those reasons. It's a time-consuming and gradual process of building this mutual trust where experiments and our practices through the demo blocks shows them the progress vis-a-vis the regular farmers or the control farmers or the other farmers in the traditional methods. These help build, you know, the level of confidence, because then the results are evident and right before their eyes. That's how you gradually build the trust. The local partners also play a very important role, because they are known to the geography, known to the farmers and various other organizations and bodies. They help their participation and engagement. Basically, we leverage, and it helps, you know, take the leap and bound, you know, times of building those relations.
So what have you gone to do differently? What are the outcomes, and why is it regenerative?
Yeah, so I think it's better agricultural practices, looking at pesticide, fertilizer application. And then also, there's quite a lot of technology and new technology. So drone usage is quite popular. But how effective is it, and how can we use those new techniques in Turkey to also drive better practices? So as you say, better farming techniques. And then it's looking at biodiversity on the farm and looking at those border crops, looking at the bird life, looking at insect life as well. So things where there is common crossover into an India or Pakistan context.
From what I understand, you've reduced input costs and yield has also improved. Is that right, Darla?
In this case, in Turkey? That is correct. While our impact analysis are still going on, but from our preliminary tests and analysis, we have seen improved yield. Not quote the numbers or the figures here, but definitely a decent significant increase in yield with comparison to the control farmers through our practices. And it's just year one itself. It's largely about what not should be practiced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and changing that mindset is what the stepping stone is for us. Through certain practices which, to their mind, they might be doing right or good, but eventually in the medium to long run might be damaging for the soil, for the land. So how to reduce those bad practices is what are one of our key stresses on, and which has shown some good results in the first year itself.
We must be fair and say this is only in the first year. It sounds like some excellent achievement so far. And it's also important to note, of course, that regen as a paradigm to replace sustainable agriculture is pretty young as well. Of course, the term's been around for a long time. And you're already seeing some excellent results here in Gujarat around regen, which I think you're about to publish in your next impact report. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So the big question to finish off is, and so what? Guilty-feeling brands can fund Cotton Connect to help 5% of Gujarati's cotton farmers or 500 Turkish farmers to become better, and we can start to call that regenerative early days. But so what? In terms of a global change perspective, in terms of making a bigger impact, how are we going to leverage the great work that you've done to avoid Cotton Connect being another one of these slightly bigger pilot programs that's helped 5,000 smallholders?
Well, to start with, over time, we've worked with 770,000 farmers. And then if you look at the farming family, that's impacting the lives of 4 million people.
So that's been more than 5,000.
It is a bit more than 5,000. And then I think in overall, cotton volume really is about 2% of global cotton volumes. There's still more to do, but I feel that in the last 10 years, we've made really significant progress. And I think you're right, we need to scale up. This needs to go to all farmers. We're obviously here in Gujarat, and it's great to see the government of India having farmers as part of their forward policy. We've got the textile ministry has got a big conference coming up in February. This sort of movement within government and within other organisations, I think for us is really important. If we're going to get that traction and scale. We've got proven techniques. We know it can work. We can trace the cotton. We've met an amazing gin owner today who's really committed to sustainability and ethics in his business. So we've got all the signals for fantastic growth future.
I see you've got some ambitious 2030 targets. One of them is, I think, around massively reducing carbon emissions. Is that right?
We've got carbon front and centre of the work we do, and really sitting against climate change, which we see as having an enormous impact in farming communities. So we're looking at a 50% reduction in carbon emissions against a 2017 baseline. So a pretty aggressive goal that we set ourselves. If we don't aim high, I really think we're just not going to move the needle in terms of climate change mitigation that we need to deliver.
If we're really ambitious about the potential for continent, and let's just talk about Gujarat for now, where could you take the organisation by 2030 in terms of a wider impact than the many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of cotton farmers that you've already worked with?
I think there's so much to play for here. We've got the Indian government looking at a brand called Kashuri Cotton to really begin to market cotton from India. And I think if that could also have the sustainable cotton as part of it and have regenerative in that, that could be the future. We're successful, then we don't exist. Maybe that's the goal, that we're so successful that others have taken it forward.
Do you think there's potential for the landscape and jurisdictional approach to bring in other acts? Again, if we just think about Gujarat for now, do you think there's some potential there to work towards?
Yes, absolutely. It's good quality cotton. It's at the heart of manufacturing. We've got the farmers. I tend to find Gujarati farmers, you give a little bit of information and they soar in terms of delivery and impact. So yes, absolutely.
Excellent. Well, thank you both, Dawa and Alison. If you want to know more about what CompConnect are doing, there's plenty on the Innovation Forum website. You might be listening to this on our podcast feed. But keep an eye on our YouTube channel, sign up to our email updates, because we will be putting out what we think will be a very good documentary explaining the story of traceability and regeneration for Gujarat cotton, which will be out in a couple of months' time. In the meantime, Dawa, Alison, thank you for your hospitality, my patience, and your generosity here in India. And we'll look forward to continuing to support your important work. Thank you.
Thank you, Toby.
The Innovation Forum website is, as ever, the place to go for all the latest analysis and interviews and all the details about our upcoming conference series and how to join us. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and until next time, goodbye.